Welcome. Welcome to the Athenaeum of Philadelphia, one of the city's cultural gems. I'm delighted to see members here, and I'm also delighted to see guests, and I'm delighted to see members of the speaker's extended family. It is a particular pleasure for me to introduce our speaker. Stephen Kahn holds the W.E. Smith Chair in History at Miami University in Ohio. His many books and articles have reached from architecture to urban history to politics, museums, and the heritage of Native American culture. His lectures have taken him from Australia to China, from Finland to Iceland, from Germany to Poland, and a lot of points in between. He is also the founder of one of the most important online history projects currently going, called Origins. His latest book, which will be coming out in October, has the provocative title, and I hope you'll look for it in your bookshops in October, Nothing Succeeds Like Failure, The Sad History of American Business Schools. Join me in welcoming Stephen Kahn.
Well, thank you for that. If you think you're seeing double, approximately you are. And I will not be talking about the history of business schools tonight, except to say that, of course, the book is due out in the fall, and so your holiday gift-giving dilemmas will be solved once it hits the bookstores. It's really quite wonderful for me to be here, and not only because I'm a member, and not only because, as it happens, I know the person who runs this place. It seems to me exactly the right place to be talking about Henry David Thoreau. The Athenaeum, as it happens, is 3 years older than Thoreau. This institution was founded in 1814. Thoreau was born in 1817. He never came to Philadelphia, as far as I am aware. He avoided cities altogether as much as he could. But if he had come here, I'm quite certain he would have visited this place. So let me put my cards on the table to start with. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not an ethicist. Nor am I a legal thinker. But I am a historian. And so I thought I'd take you on a historical excursion this evening as you watch the sun go down behind me. The word resistance has been much in the air the last few years, as I am sure you are all aware. And indeed, I think this institution is participating in a citywide project on resistance and its history in this city. And so that has given me the excuse to go back to the source of that idea, at least in the United States. And so I ask you to spend some time with me this evening thinking about Thoreau. In mid-April 1963, Martin Luther King found himself with some time on his hands. It wasn't free time, of course, because as many of you probably know, King was sitting in a jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama. Sitting in that cell, King's thoughts turned to another American sitting in another jail cell over 1,000 miles away and 120 years in the past. During my early college days, King recalled a few years later, I read Thoreau's essay, Civil Disobedience, for the first time. Notice, he said for the first time. It would not be the last. That essay became something of a touchstone for King. He came back to it again and again. For example, as he was gearing up for the bus boycott in Montgomery in 1955. From reading Thoreau, King, quote, became convinced that non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And as many of you also know, King used his time in that jail cell to write his own letter, which has become a classic text of American political and intellectual history. But I'll get to that later. My text today is from the Book of Henry. Henry David Thoreau, and his essay originally titled Resistance to Civil Government, and commonly known now as On Civil Disobedience. In this historian's humble opinion, any discussion of resistance, of dissent, the ethics of it, the need for it, the utility of it, needs to begin with Thoreau. I've probably taught this essay a dozen times over the years. It thrills me, it challenges me, it troubles me. And so I stand before you this evening with the intention of challenging and troubling you too. And in the process, I hope I can convince you that this essay is still worth reading, still worth wrestling with, and maybe together we can come to some conclusions about why it has been so important. So, quick show of hands. How many of you have actually read Henry David Thoreau's On Civil Disobedience? Okay, almost half, I would say. That's excellent. How many of you have read it recently? Okay, so let's start with a quick refresher. On July 23rd, 1846, Henry David Thoreau was arrested by the sheriff of Concord, Massachusetts, for refusing to pay his poll tax in the amount of $1. He was arrested almost exactly in the middle of his two-year experiment living in a one-room cabin on the edge of Walden Pond, and that would result in his most famous and enduring book. The arrest briefly interrupted his sojourn at the pond, a fact he very casually mentions in the middle of Walden. He spent exactly a day and a night in jail before some anonymous friend paid the tax and Thoreau was released. He got his shoe fixed, which was the ostensible reason he went to town in the first place, and then he went back to Walden and continued on with that experiment there. In 1848, however, he came back to the experience in a lecture he gave before the Concord Lyceum. He reworked the lecture into an essay and published it in the following year, 1849. It was republished again in 1866, though this time 4 years after Thoreau's death, and with the title we know today, On Civil Disobedience. It put that phrase into common usage and unleashed it on the nation. Eventually. In fact, in 1849, the essay sank like a stone among American readers. The very few reviewers who commented on it dismissed it out of hand, and the journal in which it appeared folded after the first issue, though I'm not sure Thoreau should be blamed for that. By the outbreak of the First World War, Thoreau's reputation as a writer and thinker had been cemented. One critic, writing in 1913, noted that Walden and A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, and I quote here, have been accepted as classics. The essays on forest trees and wild apples were found to be in a school reader 25 years ago, 25 years from 1913. But, the critic went on, the ringing revolt of the essay Civil Disobedience is still silenced under the thick respectability of our times. It's a great phrase, thick respectability. The ideas in it could not today be printed in the magazine which was for years owned by the publishers of Thoreau's complete works, unquote. In fact, one of the most fervent American admirers of On Civil Disobedience at the turn of the 20th century was the radical Emma Goldman, described by none other than J. Edgar Hoover as, quote, the most dangerous woman in America. A badge of honor, to be sure, but Goldman's admiration probably did not help the reputation of Thoreau's essay in that culture of thick respectability. Unappreciated at home, perhaps, but Thoreau's essay had a life outside the United States. The great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy was profoundly influenced by Thoreau for a number of reasons, but he singled out Civil Disobedience as particularly important to him. Tolstoy thought it was Thoreau's most important work. A generation later, in another hemisphere, Mohandas Gandhi read Thoreau while living in South Africa in the first years of the 20th century. In remarks he then made in 1931, Gandhi exclaimed, "Why, I actually took the name of my movement from Thoreau's essay. Until I read that essay, I had never found a suitable English translation for my Indian word Satyagraha." There is no doubt that Thoreau's ideas greatly influenced my movement in India, unquote. I've done a bit of research just to confirm that the phrase civil disobedience starts to pop up in the press with regularity in the 1920s and almost always in connection with India and with Gandhi. Fast forward 10 years later, and we have a short but nonetheless extraordinary testimony to the power of Thoreau's ideas written by an anonymous member of the Danish resistance during World War II. This person, him or her, I do not know, wrote that Thoreau's civil disobedience stood for me and my first leader in the resistance movement as a shining light. I lent Thoreau's books to friends, told them about him, and our circle grew. Railroads, bridges, and factories that worked for the Germans were blown up. The essay ends with the resistance fighter yearning, quote, rather than visit the Acropolis, I would go to Walden and to his grave. It's extraordinary. You read Thoreau, you blow up a German factory. It's quite remarkable. Move forward another two decades, and this time to Israel. In 1962, 1 year before Martin Luther King wound up in that jail cell in Birmingham, and 3 years before his own death, the great Austrian-Israeli philosopher Martin Buber summed up Thoreau's meaning to the world. Buber had grown up in the world of 20th century European philosophy in the early years of the 20th century, but he had to flee that world, of course, in 1938. And while he is usually thought of in the same philosophical company with Kierkegaard and Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, in 1962, he acknowledged that he read Civil Disobedience as a young man, and, quote, I read it with the strong feeling that here was something that concerned me directly, unquote. It took Buber a while to figure out what that to reckon with that feeling. Not till till very much later, he writes, did I understand the origin of this feeling, and he put it this way, quote, by speaking as concretely as he does about his own historical situation, Thoreau expresses exactly that which is valid for all human history. So there's the thrill of the essay for me. From Russia to South Africa, to India, to Denmark, to Alabama, the power of ideas exerted on the right side of history. And the genius of the essay, too, that Thoreau could translate his own small conflict with power in a small corner of the world and make it meaningful to so many different people in so many different places and at so many critical junctures in history. So what is it about this essay, this ringing revolt, that has proved so powerful and inspiring and seductive? Well, here's where we get to the challenging part, at least for me. At its broadest, Thoreau uses the essay to explain why he was arrested and how he responded. He was asked to pay his taxes, and when asked to do so, he refused. So he tells us because he opposed the Mexican-American War, a war he described in the very first paragraph as, quote, the work of comparatively a few individuals using the standing government as their tool, unquote. The people, he continues, would not have consented to this measure. Historians, as it happens, largely now agree with Thoreau's assessment of the war, an imperialistic land grab by an expansive nation whipped up by the worst sorts of jingoism. Thoreau refers to Mexico 6 times in the essay, but as a rationale for his actions, it is a small, autobiographical sleight of hand. The Mexican War was launched in 1845, the very year the Athenaeum purchased this lot to build this building. Thoreau got himself arrested the following year, and the war concluded in 1848. But in fact, Thoreau had been refusing to pay his taxes since 1842. The war, in other words, might have prompted Sam Staples, the town sheriff, to arrest Henry, but it was not the cause of his protest. Slavery was, and it is certainly fair to say that the expansion of slavery was a central motivation for the Mexican War in the first place. He brings these two issues together when he wrote, in other words, when 1/6 of the population of a nation which has undertaken to be the refuge of liberty are slaves, and a whole country is unjustly overrun and conquered by a foreign army and subjected to military law, I think that it is not too soon for honest men to rebel and revolutionize. It's wonderful the way Thoreau puts you now in the position of the Mexican, invaded by a foreign army and subjected to military control. Not paying his poll tax and going to jail as a consequence constituted Thoreau's personal act of rebellion. Interestingly, however, he does not indict slavery itself in the essay. Thoreau feels the evil of slavery is self-evident. When he mentions his arrest in Walden, he says almost matter-of-factly, "I went to the village to get a shoe from the cobblers. I was seized and put in jail because, as I have elsewhere related, I did not pay a tax to or recognize the authority of a state which buys and sells men, women, and children like cattle at the door of its Senate House." And he leaves it at that. So while civil disobedience reveals Thoreau to be vehemently opposed to slavery, it is not, strictly speaking, an anti-slavery tract of the sort that circulated in abundance in the 1840s. Thoreau isn't interested in persuading the reader that slavery is an evil institution. He starts with that as a given. He doesn't deign to entertain the pro-slavery, anti-slavery debates that swirled with such energy in the antebellum decade. It's beneath Thoreau's contempt even to engage in a more protracted discussion of whether slavery is right or wrong. He has a different purpose. Instead, he is merciless towards what he sees as the complicity with slavery on the part of his neighbors and fellow citizens of Massachusetts. There are thousands who are, in opinion, opposed to slavery and to the war, Thoreau chastised, who yet in effect do nothing to put an end to them. He went on, and not very kindly, about those who, esteeming themselves children of Washington and Franklin, sit down with their hands in their pockets and say that they know not what to do and do nothing. Worse, he goes on, are those who even postpone the question of freedom to the question of free trade. They hesitate and they regret and sometimes they petition, but they do nothing in earnest and with effect. Notice, three times in that paragraph, Thoreau repeats the phrase, do nothing. It is the most damning way he can describe how complacent Americans are toward slavery, and he beats it like a drum. Thoreau has done two things here. First, he has made slavery your problem and my problem, directly and urgently. And second, he has juxtaposed opinion with action. Opinions are cheap, are cheap and easy and ultimately meaningless. Action is all that matters. What are you going to do about it, and when are you going to do it? That is the challenge, the demand of this essay. And what of poor Sam Staples, the man responsible for collecting the taxes in Concord, Massachusetts? Thoreau is no less unyielding. Quote, if the tax gatherer or any public officer asks me, as one has done, but what shall I do? My answer is, if you really wish to do anything, resign your office. In other words, every one of us is in a position to do something in the face of unacceptable injustice, refuse to pay your taxes, quit your job collecting them, but most of us are too cowardly or cautious to face that responsibility, much less act on it. Thoreau is hard, hard like granite, hard like atoning for your sins. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau's mentor, friend, and finally his eulogist, wrote, quote, of the severity of his ideal and suggested that his, quote, inexorable demand on all for perfect truth was the reason that Thoreau was, quote, a willing hermit, unquote. It isn't maybe the nicest thing to say about a friend, but Emerson is right. Thoreau was severe and inexorable and unrelenting in what he saw as his moral purpose. Reading Civil Disobedience doesn't make you feel good about yourself, and it isn't supposed to. So where are we, all of us, complacent cowards, supposed to find the courage to act, to stop talking and start doing? For Thoreau, that motivation does not come from some external form of authority, the Bible or the Constitution or the work of some philosopher, but rather from his own conscience. He uses the word, or a variation of it, 11 times in Civil Disobedience. It is the center around which the essay revolves. Thoreau sees the individual conscience as pure and clear and unambiguous, quite unlike the workings of government, which are driven by what he calls, quote, the rule of expediency. Must the citizen ever, for a moment, or in the least degree, resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience, then? The question here is rhetorical. Of course, we should never give up our conscience in the name of expediency. For Thoreau, conscience is synonymous with what Emerson called his perfect truth. Nothing is worth sacrificing that for. And here is where the essay starts to trouble me. Given how influential civil disobedience has been to political movements around the world and here in the United States, it is fair to ask what kind of a political statement Thoreau is making here, or whether this is really a political document at all. The essay is certainly not a political rallying cry. There is no exhortation to the reader to turn individual conscience into some kind of collective action. It is striking how much of the essay is framed around negative actions rather than positive ones, non-cooperation, non-compliance. The essay is filled with the words resign, refuse, receding. All of these apply, in effect, walking away, rather than engaging with the world and with others. The closest Thoreau comes to expressing a political collective goal is when he extrapolates his own action onto others. If 1,000 men, Thoreau writes, were not to pay their tax bills this year, that would not be a violent and bloody measure as it would be to pay them and enable the state to commit violence and shed innocent blood. This is, in fact, the definition of a peaceable revolution, if any such is possible. The sum of 1,000 individual acts of conscience adds up to a peaceable revolution. I think it's fair to ask if that's really plausible. I'm not so sure. And even if it is, I think it's also fair to ask what kind of a society would we have the day after that revolution? Thoreau provides no answer to that. There is something also that should give us pause about Thoreau's insistence that the individual conscience is the primary source of authority. He writes in paragraph 4, quote, "The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think is right." I'm going to read that again. "The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time that which I think is right." That assertion is Thoreau's explanation of why he did not pay his taxes. By his reckoning and his reckoning alone, it was the right thing to do. But of course, that sentence could also summarize the justification for any number of monstrous acts, homicidal and genocidal, committed by men, and yes, almost always men, who were sure they knew what was right and acted accordingly. Thoreau himself recognized that there might be a problem with conscience. He drafted his book, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, while he was living in his Walden cabin, and in it he wrote, "The conscience really does not and ought not to monopolize the whole of our lives any more than the heart or the head. It is as liable to disease as any other part. I have seen some whose consciences, owing undoubtedly to former indulgence, had grown to be as irritable as spoiled children," unquote. But that more nuanced conception of our individual conscience is simply not there in civil disobedience. So Thoreau's essay is surely a statement of dissent and resistance, but does it help us to understand the ethics of dissent? Ethics is usually defined as the branch of philosophy that deals with moral principles which govern and guide our behavior. Ethical debates are those which help us refine what we mean by notions of good and right and how we define those standards. And in this sense, I'm not sure Thoreau helps us much. His is a statement of radical individualism. He seems to imply, and I say seems because he doesn't quite state it explicitly, that if others were to act according to their consciences with the same commitment to ethical individualism, everything would turn out better in the end. But what happens when two acts of conscience move in diametrically opposed directions? How do we resolve conflicts between individual consciences? And let me take an example of that conundrum from the text. Thoreau insists he isn't opposed to taxes in principle, and as such, he tells us he has always paid his highway tax because he wants to be a good neighbor, and good roads make good neighbors, in Thoreau's view. It is the poll tax, with its implied allegiance to the state, capital S, that he refuses to pay. Well, what if my conscience insists to me that driving cars is killing the planet, and supporting the highway tax, therefore, is morally wrong? Doesn't Thoreau's vision of society degenerate pretty quickly into a kind of a la carte menu of obligations and responsibility? Is it, in fact, a vision of a functional society at all? And what if that individual act of dissent, carried out because individual conscience demands it, turns out not to matter much at all to the world beyond the individual? I'll press on that question by talking about a second sleight of hand in the essay. I've mentioned already that while Thoreau puts the Mexican War as the reason for his protest, in fact, he'd been refusing to pay his taxes for 3 years before the war started. Likewise, he implies that the taxes he refused to pay would have helped pay for a government that went to war against Mexico and that supported slavery. I cannot for an instant, Thoreau thundered, recognize that political organization as my government, which is the slaves' government also. But strictly speaking, his money had nothing to do either with the war or with slavery. The tax he refused to pay went to Middlesex County, Massachusetts, and to Thoreau's own town of Concord. The federal government paid for the war through tariffs and the sale of public land and by taking out loans, which reminds us that some things don't change that much. In fact, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts had passed a personal liberty law forbidding the use of any state money to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. It's tough to argue that Massachusetts in the 1840s was the slaves' government, and it's just as tough to argue that Thoreau's action really contributed to the freeing of slaves or to the destruction of the slave system, even if it had been repeated by all of his neighbors in Concord. A symbolic act, then. And I think that raises interesting questions about the relationship between symbolic gestures and political effectiveness. But symbolic exactly of what? On the surface, Thoreau directs his protest against a specific policy of a specific administration, again, the Mexican War, and then against an American system of government with slavery at its heart. But underneath those, run a suspicion of government altogether. Quote, government in which the majority rule in all cases cannot be based on justice, unquote. Thoreau insists this, and then he asks, can there not be a government in which the majorities do not virtually decide right and wrong, but conscience? That's an interesting question, but I'm not sure I have an answer to it. He asks later in the essay, how does it become a man to behave toward the American government today? And then he answers, he cannot without disgrace be associated with it. Indeed, Thoreau seems dismissive of democracy altogether, writing, quote, all voting is a sort of gaming, like checkers or backgammon, with a moral tinge to it. In fact, Thoreau starts the essay very first two sentences. Read like this. I heartily accept the motto that the government is best which governs least, and I should like to see it acted upon more rapidly and systematically. Carried out finally, it amounts to this, which I also believe, that government is best which governs not at all. He has no use for government, it would appear, and he argues that no one really does either. In the second paragraph, he denounces government's utility altogether. Quote, yet this government never of itself furthered any enterprise but by the alacrity with which it got out of its way. It does not keep the country free. It does not settle the West. It does not educate. The character inherent in the American people has done all that has been accomplished. And it would have done somewhat more if the government had not sometimes got in its way. Those who take Thoreau as a progressive hero ought to acknowledge that those lines very well might have come from Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign or from the American Enterprise Institute last week. Or they might have come from Emma Goldman, the radical I mentioned a moment ago, who so admired Thoreau at the turn of the 20th century. Goldman described her own politics as anarchist, and while she was a Jewish immigrant, she claimed her politics were entirely American-grown. In a 1901 interview, Goldman told the reporter, Americans who insist on believing that anarchy was foreign revolution are finding out that their own Emerson and Thoreau said more sensible anarchical things than any of our professed anarchists. Goldman referred to Thoreau as, quote, the greatest American anarchist, and in her essay, Anarchism, What Does It Really Stand For?, Goldman quotes extensively from Civil Disobedience. Radical right or radical left, civil disobedience can point in either direction or both or neither. My point is that the radical individualism that Thoreau models does not really have a goal beyond fidelity to one's own conscience. It is the political end unto itself, not necessarily the means to get somewhere else. In other words, it's hard for me, as I read the essay, to see how these ideas lead us to social change or meaningful political engagement. Which brings us back to Birmingham in 1963, and you thought I had forgotten about that. So here we are. If Thoreau's essay traveled widely around the world in the decades after it was first published, it finally found its American audience after the Second World War. First with the Civil Rights Movement, later with the Free Speech Movement, the movement against the war in Vietnam, and the environmental movement. Martin Luther King was not the only one reading Thoreau in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. There are two obvious parallels between King's letter from Birmingham jail and the essay by Thoreau that King encountered as a college student. The first is the very act of writing it in and from jail in the first place. Among the most famous lines in Civil Disobedience is the one where Thoreau inverts the very idea of prison itself. Under a government which imprisons unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. When Thoreau was sitting in that jail, Ralph Waldo Emerson walked up to the window and asked, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau replied, Emerson, what are you doing out there? Actually, the story is probably not true, but it should be. For countless political prisoners, that line and Thoreau's insistence that jailing the body has no impact at all on the freedom of mind has provided some solace. We call them now prisoners of conscience, and Thoreau might have smiled. And here, another plug for a summer reading list. The most moving account I've ever read of a writer in prison remains Joseph Brodsky's reflections on his time in a Soviet prison as a dissident, one who dissents. And perhaps the library here even has that. If it doesn't, you should get on the guy that runs the place to get a copy. The second parallel between King and Thoreau is in their purpose. Just as Thoreau did not use his essay simply to issue a bill of indictment against slavery, King didn't use this letter to make a vigorous argument against segregation. Instead, and again, many of you know this letter, the letter is addressed to his fellow ministers, white ministers. And like Thoreau did with his neighbors, King took them to task for their complacency in the face of injustice. I have been disappointed with the church, King wrote bluntly. But he was disappointed with what he called the moderate white liberals who kept urging caution and patience. They seem, in King's estimation, more interested in order than in justice, like Thoreau's neighbors concerned with expediency rather than with what is right. To those moderates, King wrote, "We have been patient for 340 years. But much as King had Thoreau on his mind in 1963, I also think he recognized the weakness in civil disobedience that I've tried to highlight tonight. At the beginning of paragraph 16, Thoreau poses this question: unjust laws exist. Shall we be content to obey them, or shall we endeavor to amend them and obey them until we have succeeded, or shall we transgress them at once? That was exactly the crux of King's dilemma in Birmingham. But notice again that Thoreau makes no attempt here to define what an unjust law is, and therefore how we might agree on a course of action beyond the dictates of individual conscience. That is the challenge that King takes up, and perhaps the most important work his letter does. How does one determine when a law is just or unjust? King asks, almost as if answering Thoreau directly, and he offers a three-part answer. First, a just law is a man-made law that squares and does not contradict what King calls moral law or God's law. Any law, I'm quoting, that degrades human personality is an unjust law by that standard. Second, a law is unjust if it is made and enforced by one group, but not binding on it. A law can only be just if it applies equally to everyone, something my small son kept trying to insist to me over the years. King's final category are those laws that are imposed on people who had no opportunity to participate in the lawmaking process. Legal segregation, therefore, by all three of King's measures, fails the test. Those laws, therefore, stand as unjust. Not only can they be broken, but there is a moral, I could add, civic imperative to do so. Here, then, King does provide us with an ethics of dissent, not civil disobedience as a whim or as an individual action, but as a response to a set of criteria we can all evaluate and agree upon. In this sense, I think he has taken Thoreau and done him one better. He has turned an individual act into something collective. So, does anyone read Thoreau today, other than my students, because they have an exam on it shortly? Should anyone read Civil Disobedience anymore? Is he still, I hesitate to use the word, relevant anymore? Well, yes, I think, but precisely because of the questions he raises and the provocations he issues. There are, as I read it, no answers here, certainly no easy ones, but Thoreau never intended to give you easy answers in the first place. We live, I think, unarguably at a vexed moment in our history, and we share that with Thoreau. The word resist has appeared on bumper stickers, banners, in New York Times editorials, in my email box over and over and over again in the last 2 years. That very notion that we should resist our own government traces directly back to Thoreau. Remember the original title of the essay, Resistance to Civil Government. And there are plenty of people, perhaps some of us, who share Thoreau's description of the man with his hands stuffed in his pocket, doing nothing. My own congressman, one of your own senators, certainly fits that bill. Opinions are cheaper now than they were in the 1840s, thanks to Twitter and the rest. Action, meaningful, effective action, seems just about as thin on the ground now as it was when Thoreau refused to pay his taxes. Thoreau believed that if each of us were to examine our own conscience honestly, if we were to stare at our ethical selves in the mirror without flinching, we would be compelled to pull our hands out of our pockets and put them to the work of social change. But many hands, as the cliche goes, make light work, and so perhaps the biggest challenge Thoreau leaves us with is how to get others to join their hands with ours. As we read Civil Disobedience today, we realize that conscience is a powerful force in the world, or it ought to be, but conscience plus community is what can move those proverbial mountains.